When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Wait, have you not seen the director's cut? Have you only seen the theatrical cut with the voiceover?
Yeah.
Meredith. We're talking about different movies.
My assignment wasn't to see the director's cut.
We're talking about different movies.
I went.
It's so fucking different. That's insane. I'm sorry. It never occurred to me. You have to hunt out the theatrical cut. I had no idea.
No, it's the only thing that came up. I went to watch it. I had to rent it. And it was, I'm pretty sure the theatrical, it had a voiceover.
Had Harrison Ford saying, that was city speak in the beginning. A pigden of all these different languages.
I was not given options.
You should watch it again. You should watch the director's cut. So I'm serious.
you gotta
sorry.
These nuggets I'm of knowledge so in your head. You gotta have them come out your mouth.
Fair enough.
You're on Midnight Local, the podcast from How to Drink, where we just talk about things.
Movies.
Pop culture.
Maybe some video games.
That too. All the things.
The things. The stuff and things.
All of the stuff and the things on Midnight Local.
Let's get to it.
Welcome back to Midnight Local, your podcast about the fuck ever.
Genius.
I feel like we should deliver more on the what the fuck ever parts of this show, though. I feel like we have not really.
What the fuck ever?
I don't think we've done enough what the fuck evers.
We need we need one of those podcasting neon lights that says like off topic that we just like turn on when we go off topic. And then we turn it off when we come back to the point. I don't know why it has a pull string in my imagination. Like you have to reach back and like.
A lot of neon lights do have a pull string, so. Maybe we should try recording an episode too, where we just bullshit and see what happens if we start talking about movies or not and stuff like that. Because maybe like that's how we fulfill one, it'd be easy. And two, you know, maybe we get into some real off topic-y stuff that's good for the show that way, you know, deliver on our permanent off topic promise.
Yes. We did that a little bit with Gladiator, but
we did. Yeah. I guess knowing that we both watched a thing. Is probably a good place to start. So we're talking about Blade Runner today, which is, you know, Blade Runner. It's like a seminal movie. That's the wrong word. Well, it kind of is. Actually, seminal is the right word. It is the seminal cyberpunk film.
Yeah.
It is the first movie that we can truly call cyberpunk. I've had some people say, well, it's not cyberpunk. I'm going to explain why it is later. It's Blade Runner. It is like a big deal. I think that if you're uninitiated, you know, if you're film interested, if you're a movie file, you hear Blade Runner, you see some images from it, you think, but it's not like a good movie. It's like a big spectacle piece. I had like that attitude once when I was young, I think. It's a big
with
action
Blade Runner
movie.
Specifically?
With like anything, you know, that wasn't like high, like a black and white 90s art house film or something like
Oh.
You know, like I went through my snobbery. But like, in fact, Blade Runner is one of the movies that, I mean, it's a movie that is taught at film. It's a important piece of cinema, like so many movies that happen to also have high production value. It's like there was just like a 90s thing where it was like, hey man, it's got to be Dogma 95 or else I'm not even interested and like all that.
You know,
shit.
What was interesting about this one for me as I was looking into it is like they set out to make something mainstream, but they never really quite had the budget for it because a lot of things that happened in between. So the intention was a high budget spectacle and they ended up with that, but in the weirdest way possible.
Yeah.
Like they lost their studio because the studio ran out of money. Then they had to reshop this film like three or four times in the middle of like set building. And then they had some combination of like Warner Brothers put forward some money, but then it was like private film financiers who really got this movie made. But it falls under the Warner Brothers studio because they were the studio that gave it money and probably distributed it. But
they're the distributor. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Ridley. So first off, this is Ridley Scott's third movie, which is kind of crazy.
It's after Alien.
Yeah. He had done The Duelists, Alien, and then this. It's movie number three. Yeah. He had directed commercials for years before that. And he really is a cinematographer slash director. If you read about the guy, he knows cameras. And it's funny because they both did the movies from the same series, but you hear the same thing about James Cameron. Like particularly like now, I think that's a lot more common because it's easier to pick up and learn that stuff. But back in the days of film, like that was a specialty, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Being really technical about it.
Exactly. From what I have read, directors who said, I want you to shoot this on this lens at this aperture with this shutter speed, you know, that was an uncommon thing for a director to be able to do. They would say, I would like it to look like this. Let me see the framing. Oh, that works. But like, yeah, like Ridley, Cameron, they like knew what they wanted. They could grab, Cameron operates his own camera, which is crazy. I don't know that Ridley does that all the time, but I'm pretty sure I've seen him operate. He can.
Well, and you see it in the way that people talk about the film. Like I'm reading up in front of me a piece of trivia, and it's like, you know, director Ridley Scott and the director of photography like achieved this shot by doing this. It's not
right.
Like even with why Orson Welles' cinematographer on Citizen Kane gets top billing is because he was the mastermind figuring out all of that. And
oh yeah,
you credit him with that. And with Ridley Scott, it sounds like it's like, yeah, he's got his director of photography who's definitely helping him, but his hands are in that as well.
Who is the cinematographer on that though? I'm going to find out right now.
On Citizen Kane.
Jordan Cronenworth. I mean, I'm not like, so I'm not a guy who knows all the cinematographers, but Jordan Cronenworth was the cinematographer. He did a hell of a job on this. I don't know what else he did.
Sorry, just to clarify, Jordan Cronenworth was the cinematographer on Blade Runner.
I thought you were looking up
Citizen Kane.
Oh, no, I know that guy. It's Greg Toland. Yeah. I mean, I know that off the top of my head. And actually, to the exact point you were just making, I love that now we're comparing Blade Runner to Citizen Kane. But honestly, I think it's the same. They are on the same tier. They have that level of influence together. But yes, Orson Welles, it's his first movie. And I've seen him in interviews saying, well, the only reason I was able to make it was because I didn't know you couldn't. I was telling our camera department to do things that no one had ever done with a camera before. I didn't know they hadn't been done with a camera before. I didn't know that hadn't been done in editing before. I had no background. He was a theater director. He was directing the Mercury Playhouse in New York, I think, which was actually a Works Public project. It's like the WPA arts thing. So he had like all these grants. Like he got to do, he did a production of, it would probably have aged very poorly, but he did do an all black production of, not Hamlet, the play, the Scottish play. Why can't I think of its actual name?
Macbeth.
Yeah. And he like recast it to be like a story in Haiti and stuff like that. And, I don't know. I mean, there wasn't blackface in it. You know what I mean? Like and he was extremely progressive guy for his era. So I don't know. I bet it was probably actually, it may have aged pretty well. I would not be entirely surprised if that were the case. You know, I'm sure if he was doing anything where he was sticking his foot in it, somebody would have said, hey, Orson, you know, maybe we want to do it this way.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, it was his first movie. And as he said, he didn't know he couldn't do things. Which is what your point is about, like, you know, the relationship between a cinematographer and a director. A lot of times the director has like really very limited technical knowledge, or they used to be more common. I don't think that's common anymore. I don't want to only talk about this movie from a technical perspective, but we really should talk about it from a technical perspective because it is the height of a kind of an art form that I think no longer exists in a lot of ways.
What do you mean?
Okay. We'll talk about it now. I did not realize it until I saw this in an interview or maybe I read it in a book, but that somebody pointed out, never again will a movie be made the way that that movie mm-hmm. was made, because
yeah.
it was made that way like before technology let you do it a different way. So there's no blue screens in Blade Runner. There's no compositing. There's no optical printer use even.
Yeah.
Everything you see is in the camera, right? There are stop motion sequences. There are miniature sequences. There's a very famous one where we see the spinner. That's the cop flying cop car that Deckard uses
mm-hmm.
Coming in over the city. And we've got the mm-hmm. blimp and the holographic Shigeisha, the holographic advertisement in the whole city and everything like that. So they did that all in camera with, if I'm not mistaken, 15 passes. And it's all motion controlled. So everything can repeat the movement exactly the same way. And the way that you do that is you take, let's say you have ISO 800 film. And so for those of you who aren't film people, that's the speed at which the film, they call it film speed, absorbs light. So faster film, you can shoot in darker conditions because it's more sensitive, right? Mm-hmm. Slower film, you know, you need to shoot ASA 100, ISO 100, ASA and ISO are interchangeable. You know, you'd be shooting in broad daylight. You know, 400 is good for like a cloudy day, you know, afternoon and early morning. And then when you want to shoot indoors, you need to be 800, maybe even faster. You know, shooting at night, you need a lot of speed, you know, 3200, maybe push it to 64. So you take your exposure, you say, well, here's the lighting, here's our film speed, here is our shutter speed. You know, this is how much time per exposure we're giving the camera. Here's our aperture. Do the math. What is, what's the exposure time that we would need to properly expose that image? And let's say it's an eighth of a second shutter. You know, you need an eighth of a second shutter, or actually typically in film, it's a half second shutter because of the way that the shutter actually works on reflex motion picture cameras. So whatever. You don't really play with your shutter speed that much. But for argument's sake, let's say it's an eighth of a second. Okay, I want to do all of these effects in this crazy moving stop motion shot. You know, we have the actual shapes that we want to make sure we capture. We want to get the lights in the windows we want to capture. We want to make sure we get this holographic thing that we're going to project. And that's got its own luminous level. And we want to get the tail lights on the spinner. Then we want to come in, we want to put atmosphere in the air, we want to put fog in it, we want to illuminate that so that we see all of that. All of those things have to be done as different passes so that you can have specific controls over them and specific levels of exposure. So you take that eighth second of exposure time that would fully expose the camera. We're going to do 15 passes. You have to divide that by 15 so that you're only ever doing that much of an exposure at a time at that level of light. And it's even more complicated than that because every time you're doing a pass, you're probably using different amounts of light, right? So you have to keep redoing this math. And then they literally took that piece of film. They did one pass. Okay, spool it up again. Same film, put it back in there.
Mm.
Spool it up, same film. And they did that again and again and again and again. With optical printing, with compositing, you would shoot on new film with traveling mats, parts together, of it that right. weren't exposed, and then lay them together in post mm-hmm. or something like that, right? So I read that like nobody ever made a movie like that ever again.
That sounds absolutely batshit.
And you didn't know, and you spent like, you know, days getting this one stop motion sequence, and then you find out that it didn't come out.
If it didn't work, yeah. So I guess I didn't know this about Ridley Scott either, but he is a producer's nightmare.
He's a difficult apparently. Man.
Yeah. Well, but he's just like one quote I heard said that like on day one of shooting, they were all walking around saying we're 5 days behind schedule already. Like, because he was creating new problems on day one that added time everywhere. Just, I think that if this man could, he'd probably shoot one film for the rest of his life. It sounds like, unless somebody reins him in.
Oh, I don't think that's the case. I mean, he's super prolific. He puts out a movie every year, generally.
It was so bad that like the producers took creative control away from him at some point in the filming process.
Yeah, in post, they re-edited it. That's like the big story about this.
It says hours after the final scene was shot. So it was also during shooting. The final scene of the movie, not the final scene that they were shooting.
Maybe. It may have been shot sequentially too.
Maybe.
Ridley. But I do know that once it was in the can, for sure he lost control. And that's why there's been so many re-releases of the movie.
Right.
Which we'd have to dive into. So to his credit, except for maybe like Prometheus and stuff like that, and the Alien sequels, which are not great, I don't think the guy's got a miss. You know, I mean, I think he clearly knows what he was doing. I mean, maybe I should pull up his IMDb and just take a peek and see if there's anything that's garbage in there.
Well, he made one of my favorite movies of all time.
What's that?
Thelma and Louise.
Oh yeah, see, exactly. Like, and that's what's so crazy about him. He works in every genre.
Right.
So,
well, and you don't think of like Thelma and Louise, the way that it's shot, like on location, it's not backlots. It's like,
right.
In 1991, when that movie was made, you didn't see a whole lot of movies like that. I mean, that movie was just epic.
So he did a lot of music videos, and just to run through this, and like movie music films, which I can't offer commentary on. And he did commercials. Mm-hmm. But like to run through his credits here, starting from The Duelists, because before that, I certainly have no opinion on it. It's TV, it's music videos, music films. Duelists, Alien, Blade Runner, the famous 1984 Apple Macintosh commercial, Legend, Black Rain, Thelma and Louise, Conquest of Paradise, 1942, White Squall, G.I. Jane, Gladiator, Hannibal, Black Hawk Down, Matchstick Men, which is actually really cool. Kingdom of Heaven, which I actually also really enjoyed, but I haven't revisited it. All the Invisible Children, which I don't know anything about. A Good Year, which I have no any opinion of. I don't know anything about. American Gangster, I quite liked. Body of Lies, I quite liked. Robin Hood, I know people didn't like it. I loved it. It's a short film, Thunder Perfect Mind. I have no idea what that is. Prometheus, I don't know what the hell that is. The Counselor, well, I did see Prometheus. I wasn't in love with it. I think it's having kind of a resurgence. I think people are enjoying it now. Okay. It's like one of those movies where at the time, I feel like everybody was like, what the fuck is this? But I feel like, you know, like the prequels, the Star Wars prequels, I feel like younger people I see on TikTok responding to it very positively.
With it. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The Counselor. Well, they should not have. It's not a movie to grow up with. It's a fucked up movie, but sure. The Counselor, The Vatican. I don't know what that. Oh, it's a TV movie. Exodus, Gods and Kings. Okay. Yeah. So, he did The Martian. I had no idea he directed The Martian.
Yeah, he did The Martian.
Alien Covenant, which is a sequel to Prometheus. I don't know. At this point now, he's off my radar. I don't know a lot of the stuff. All the Money in the World, The Journey. He directed that TV series, Raised by Wolves, which I could not fault on its competency. It was very competent. I just could not, I had zero interest in it.
Yeah.
The Last Duel, which I never looked into it. I was wondering if it was a sequel to The Duelists, but I don't think it was. I don't think it was related to that. Oh my God, he directed House of Gucci?
That's what I saw that too and was surprised. I didn't know that.
I had no idea. Yeah, I guess what's so crazy is like he just works in any genre, every genre. He's all over the place.
Yeah.
He's not he's just a
sort of.
And I would say Thelma and Louise.
Yeah.
Blade Runner. I mean, like, yeah, it's a lot of big stories, sort of action stuff, but like he's definitely working in other stuff forms.
Is Gladiator worth a rewatch? I haven't seen that movie since I was.
I think it's a pretty good flick.
Is it? Maybe we should put that on the list.
We should put that on the list.
It's come up a lot lately and I've been itching to watch it. So might as well.
I would personally be more interested in doing Kingdom of Heaven because I have very positive memories of seeing it in the theater and I haven't checked it out since.
Okay.
But also I know there's a director's cut that is really much praised. So, we could do both. We could do a Ridley Scott series. We could do Alien. We should do Alien.
Alien. I mean, we should do Alien 1, 2, and 3 probably, right?
3?
I don't know. What is it? It's like I hear one of them comes back around, like 1, 2, 3, and 4? I don't know. Or is it just 1 and 2?
Alien and Aliens are both top-notch films. Alien 3 is interesting because it's like David Fincher's first movie.
Uh-huh.
But it was ultimately one of those things where he had very little control over it. And it got... It's the one where she's in prison. In a monastery prison. And then Alien 4 is the one where she's actually a clone because they just couldn't let the series die. and they put Winona Ryder in it. And I remember liking it. Oh, I should also put in Ron Perlman. But like, you have to understand, like, I was just into the Alien series. I have not revisited these since I had like critical taste at the time. I was just like, cool, Ripley's fucking shit up.
That's what makes it fun to revisit though. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like, maybe it doesn't actually hold up. So I would do them all. We should just do the whole series.
Why not?
And I think that there's Prometheus and the other one. And I think they do just keep making them. A lot of people.
So is Prometheus in the Alien world?
Oh, it's a prequel. Absolutely.
Oh, it is. Okay. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. It's about where the alien xenomorphs came from. A lot of people call them xenomorphs because they were referred to that way in Aliens. But xenomorph just means life from outside, like non-human. So that in that setting, they would have referred to every alien species as a xenomorph. But they just became known as xenomorphs because in the James Cameron one. Also, like the James Cameron one.
That's two, right? Like that's Aliens.
Yeah, Aliens, which he sold by writing on a whiteboard to the producers Alien and then ending it with a dollar sign. He's like, baby, we're going to make lots of money on this. and he was actually, slight tangent, he was told, don't make this movie because it's one of the greatest movies of all time. Alien is a huge hit. You're going to make a sequel. And either it's going to be garbage and you'll be compared very unfavorably to Ridley Scott. Like, what are you going to do? You're going to just do what he did again.
Yeah.
Or it'll be good and your credit will be given to Ridley Scott.
Mm.
And Cameron, not a dumb guy.
Neither is true.
No, neither is true. And he made a movie that is nothing like the first one, right? Like, it's a completely different kind of movie. It's a different genre. You can call them both science fiction, but Alien is a haunted house horror movie or like a last girl slasher, really.
Yeah. Alien, a little boring for me.
Alien is boring for you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is.
Wow. Why?
Okay. It just goes on and on. I remember at one point during the movie, like, why am I watching? It was like watching paint.
When was the last time you watched it?
3 or 4 years during COVID.
So like recent.
Yeah. Not your brain too long ago. I'll revisit it for the sake of this podcast, but I remember being pretty bored.
All right. No one would call Aliens boring.
That's, I'm sure that's true.
But Alien is a slower burn, no question.
Yeah.
No question.
And there's parts of it that are iconic that are great. The end of the movie, like, definitely.
From the shuttle
moves,
on. Anyway,
like, crazy. We're way off topic. Oh, we're on Ridley Scott. We're not that off. We're in
the universe. No, it's a tension film, though. It is a haunted house movie. Like, sure. It's supposed to be like, it's a horror movie. You have to watch it as a horror movie.
Right.
You know, it's a slasher.
Which generally, really, I like suspense building films. I don't know. I'll have to revisit it and we will talk about it on the Alien episode of this podcast coming.
This is much, maybe next.
Soon-ish.
Yeah. I don't even know how we got over here. Let's get back to
what we were talking about. We were talking about Ridley Scott's filmography.
Yeah, his career. So Blade Runner is a hugely ambitious movie off the heels of Alien. It's science fiction, but in like an aesthetic that nobody had seen before.
Right.
You know, it's like inventing this new look that really defines. I mean, like, you see people made movies that looked or tried to look like Blade Runner and comic books and manga and anime and video games and role-playing games that tried to look like Blade Runner for like another decade and a half after Blade Runner.
And that is where like Ridley Scott gets full credit for the film. I think that like, the idea to make a movie based off of what was the book. They had an idea to make a movie based
on Android's Dream of Electric Sheep.
Of Electric
Sheep.
Which
is a Philip K. Dick story.
And they couldn't find an angle that they liked, right? They wrote a lot of different versions of it. Then they brought in Philip K. Dick and he wrote the script.
Oh, he came in?
I think they were not came in. I think they shopped the idea around for a while and they weren't finding the angle they wanted to take.
I don't even know if he was alive. Hold on a second. I want to look that up. That would be
when they were talking about just like the script writing process, finding the writers, finding the people to take this on. They got turned down a lot because nobody wanted to make this book. Nobody had the vision for it.
When did Philip K. Dick die? He died the same year. He died in 82.
Did he really?
He died the year it came out.
Came out.
So he would have been just barely alive. Oh, I think he saw it. I think that's like a thing. He got to see it just before it was released or something like that.
So then for a long time, they called it Dangerous Days, was like the working title of the movie.
That's interesting.
Which is why the making of the Blade Runner is, the documentary is called Dangerous Days.
Gotcha. Well, I think about that though. Like, we all know what Blade Runner means, but like when it came out, it's not from the book.
Right.
It's just a word. It means nothing.
Exactly. I think like Ridley Scott turned it down at first because his brother just died of, or no, he turned it down. He wasn't interested. And then his brother died of cancer. And in the depression of that, he just wanted something to work on.
That's interesting.
And so he signed on to the project. And I think, you know, because he was in a pretty dark, depressed place, I think a lot of the mood of the movie comes from his state of mind.
He's the last Scott brother, because Tony Scott died
As
well. I think he took his own life.
But like, it's just, you know, you hear about movies that have this really wild process to even become, like, especially when iconic movies that feel like every beat of it is so thought out and so intentional. And you like, a million ways this movie never gets made, or it gets made and it's not iconic. It doesn't look
right.
How it looks, you know, and everything fell into place in just the right way to make this movie what it is.
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, it was exactly, everything fell into place. And then once it fell into place, somebody like Ridley Scott, he didn't want to do it, but he found a vision for it. Like, he was definitely not reluctant once he signed on. He was all in on this.
Oh, yeah. He started drawing. He started creating the sets. And he, like...
They got Sid Mead to come in and do concept work, too. He's a great... he, like, draws science fiction cars. Like, that's kind of what he does.
Yeah.
Sid Mead also was involved in the design of the DeLorean for Back to the Future.
There's a car early in this movie that they were showing a shot of in the documentary that I was like, that it looks exactly like a DeLorean.
Oh, that's cool. Not the spinner, not the actual.
I don't think so. I think it's just like goes over in the scene.
A background car. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just sort of there. But yeah, I mean, it makes sense. Everyone started to believe in this vision of the project, which is why it was able, like once it got to Warner Brothers and it was Blade Runner, it was Ridley Scott, and it had this vision behind it, there was no question they were investing in it. So,
oh yeah,
it found its rhythm before it was shooting for sure.
Oh yeah, it had to. It had to. So amazing cast. First off, well, not first off. We're way off first here. We're into
fourth off,
third off, fourth off. Yeah, you got Harrison Ford.
Yeah,
phenomenal. Obviously, Harrison Ford can do no wrong. Basically, guy's incredible.
Where is he in his career when this comes out?
82. Well, he's done Star Wars. He's done American Graffiti.
Has he done the first Indiana Jones Raiders? Or not yet? Not yet.
I don't know when Raiders. I'm going to look up when Raiders comes out.
Yeah.
I think Raiders is in 81. Yeah, Raiders of the Lost Ark is 81. So he's off of the heels of that. Of
yeah, Raiders. He's like he was the height.
He was Hollywood. He was King Hollywood, man. He was a big deal right then. And just, you know, I don't know how many guys like Harrison Ford there ever were, but like, I'm operating on the assumption that at the height of his powers, he was a dude that ladies liked. I feel like I've been told that.
I believe
But
that.
Also like a guy that like dudes like. Like, you want to be, there's not a Harrison Ford movie where you're not like, God damn it, I want to be Harrison Ford this movie.
I guess, but at the same time, like, Harrison Ford always seems like the ultimate fuckboy to me. And maybe that's because of Han, but.
Wait a minute. What does fuckboy mean? Maybe I don't understand what it means.
He's just like, or like a love bomber, like someone who's like, he has all of your attention. And then once he gets what he wants, he's like, oh, bye.
Well, I mean, on some level, I think guys want to be players.
Right. He's like, that's a player. You can call it player, fuckboy, same thing.
Oh, so what you're saying is that like, you know, that those guys, but they do fuck. So ladies do like that.
I'm not saying that they don't. That's not my point at all. I'm just saying that's what he is.
Oh, so Harrison Ford had done a lot of work. You know, you always hear that he had just been a carpenter and he got American Graffiti and he...
Right. Someone told him he was never going to be successful. And
right. The reality is that he was a guy who worked in front of and behind the camera for a while. He had done a lot of TV. It looks like he was on Gunsmoke before he got American Graffiti. He got,
okay.
He was The Intruders, Getting Straight, Zabriskie Point, like Love American Style, The FBI, like, you know, TV series episode, you know, small parts.
Probably in some commercials. I think there's a commercial with Harrison Ford famously, but I don't remember what it was.
And he'd been working since, I guess, 1966 as like an extra or a background guy. And he was doing set carpentry as well. So he wasn't a carpenter that you call to like fix your, you know, whatever, your house.
That story always makes it sound like he was plucked out of obscurity by some talent scout and thrown into a movie.
The vision I always had was like, so George Lucas had a guy working on doing, you know, in my imagination, I was like, oh, a carpenter. So he was like fine chiseling like the banister on George Lucas's staircase or whatever. And George Lucas was walking around the house like, you know what? I think you're going to be in Star Wars, kid. And like, that's what happened.
I'm going to make you a star.
He was building sets. And so he did, he did New Hope, you know, which wasn't called the New Hope then. It was just called Star Wars. And then he did some other stuff. He did Ken Boy. Well, actually, sorry. He did. That's what I wanted to know is if that was. He did American Graffiti, which was, I guess, kind of a breakout for him. Then he did one episode of Kung Fu. Then he was in The Conversation, which doesn't get discussed a lot. But that's a great movie we should do. Definitely, I think, one of my favorite movies of all time. And almost certainly my favorite Coppola movie. My favorite Francis Ford Coppola movie. Then he did something called Petrocelli TV series with Tom Brannigan. I don't know what that is. TV movie called Judgment, a TV movie called Dynasty, which I think is Dynasty, the movie. It's a TV movie called The Possessed. Then he's in Star Wars. Then he's in something called Heroes. Then he's in Force 10 from Navarone. Then he's in Star Wars Holiday Special and a short film called The Story of the Faithful Wookiee. TV again, Hanover Street. Another Coppola movie, Apocalypse Now in 79, Frisco Kid. Then a sequel to American Graffiti called More American Graffiti, which I don't fully understand because he dies in American Graffiti.
Flashbacks.
And yeah, maybe. Then he's in Empire, and then he's in Raiders, and then he's in Blade Runner. So a real overnight success here. You know what I mean? He really just exploded onto the scene. That's the truth, right? He's a 30-year making overnight success. Right?
Yeah, right. He grinded away at it for a long time.
Absolutely.
I've heard the new TV show he's in with Marshall.
Oh, Shrinking?
Yeah, I've heard that's good.
I have heard that. I kind of want to check it out.
Yeah.
So, and then he did, you know, any movie he wanted for like the rest of his career.
Yeah. Basically. Some really funny stuff. 7 Days and Seven Nights comes to mind right now. Cowboys and Aliens. He's done some funny stuff.
He's got a sense of humor. Seven Days, man. I saw that movie in high school with all my dude friends because I saw the commercial and I convinced them like, dude, it's Harrison Ford, seaplanes, adventure. This movie's going to be awesome. It's going to be like Raiders, but like not. And like we went, it was like, this is a romantic comedy,
rom-com on an island.
I guess it's a pretty good one. But
I haven't seen that since high school, I'm sure. So anyway, all that was a very long way of saying he was at the height of
Harrison Fordness.
Of a long worked for career.
So we have a great cast. We got Rutger Hauer. A couple of movies I love that he's in is Flesh and Blood. He's also in a great movie that's really hard to find anymore called Lady Hawk. Very cool 80s action movie that has, we were talking a while ago about what's your favorite D&D movie. Lady Hawk ranks very high. Matthew Broderick is in it. plays a thief. And then who else you got? You got so many great character actors. James Hong is in it. I can't remember the guy who you know, the other peoples who are in here. Daryl Hannah's in it.
Daryl Hannah.
Of course.
Yeah, Daryl Hannah. Sean Young plays Rachel.
Oh, yeah, Sean Young. She didn't do a ton of work. I hear she had some, like, issues.
I also guess, like, her and Harrison Ford had, like, zero chemistry. There's, like, a much longer cut of the sex scene between the two of them. It was supposed to be, like, you know, really earn its R rating. And there's clips of it. They shot it. Yeah. But I guess the chemistry between them was never quite there. So it got cut.
I hope I'm not speaking incorrectly. And if I am, I apologize. But I feel like I read at one point that she had a drinking problem, and the kind of drinking problem that made her basically impossible to work with for a long time. So I think that was an issue too, with why she has not done a lot. I don't think this movie works without her. She's phenomenal in this role.
She's also perfect for Everybody's the role. Perfect. Yeah. She's,
you know, you got, I don't know who some of these actors are, unfortunately, like the guy who plays Terrell. James Olmos is in it. And, that guy who always plays the same dude. He always plays like the kind of corrupt cop. What's that actor's name? M. Emmett Walsh.
Okay.
Yeah, and William Sanderson is Sebastian.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Joe Turkel.
Right.
Joe Turkel, who plays Tyrell, the head of the company. He's wearing those crazy eyeglasses, so you don't recognize him. He's the bartender in The Shining.
Oh, I see it. Oh, yeah. That's his profile picture in IMDb. Yeah. Also, James Hong is in this movie. James. Did you say him? James Hong, who is notably in every single movie. Yeah. And in Everything Everywhere All at Once, which we talked about him a bunch in that episode.
Yep. And then Brian James and Joanna Cassidy playing the other two Nexus Sixes. I don't know. I love this movie so much. It's so good. It's so... What this movie pulls off, and people are going to ask anyway, like, what did you think of Blade Runner 2048 or whatever the year is?
2049, I think.
But what did you think of that? I think that what this movie has going for it is that it's fun. And, it's the dark, it's a very dark movie. It's so depressing. It's so heavy. Yeah, but it's still fun. Blade Runner is... It's fun the way any noir is fun. Like, you want to be that detective to some degree. You want to be solving that crime. You want to be swimming in the gutters and drinking. You know, I don't know. Like, it's a...
Yeah. He's a more nuanced, conflicted character than most action heroes you see. So there's more to sink your teeth into with his... You know, when he kills the snake lady.
The snake lady.
Replicant.
Zora. But yes, the snake lady.
The snake replicant. He's conflicted about it, which is very noir-y to me. It's not Total Recall. It's not everything for my mission, for survival. You know, it's a much more interesting character to go on this journey with, because it's like, where does all that lead? Especially when you put Rachel into the mix, someone that he has feelings for.
She asks him, did you ever retire anyone who wasn't a replicant? No.
And she plants the seed. I thought this was always just a fan theory, but she does actually plant the seed that he could. How do you know you're not a replicant? If I am.
You ever take that test yourself?
Yeah, right. And they don't ever confirm or deny that he is or isn't, besides the old photo he has of a family member.
Right. And what is, I think he says, no, he never gave it to himself. If I'm not mistaken, and I haven't read Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, but I think that what I've read about Blade Runner is that it's not a question in Androids. Like, you know, he's a human. And in fact, he does have a moment where he's worried he might not be, but he gives himself a void comp and comes out okay. And I think that that's a key difference in Blade Runner, because the fucking core thing in Blade Runner, in addition to all of the other stuff that's, you know, right there for you to see, is, am I a replicant? That's like the theme of the movie.
Right.
Is Deckard a replicant? And like, for years, Ridley wouldn't answer that question, but I heard him in an interview somewhat recently. You know, at some point you may as well just tell everybody what was in your D&D campaign that they never got to see. And he's like, of course he's a replicant. Like,
yeah. Oh, he does. He yeah, says
very
that
recently. It was like within the last 5 or 10 okay. years. He's like, obviously, he's a fucking ref. Ridley is cantankerous. Huh. If you ever watch any movie with his director's commentary, he's tough. He seems like a tough guy to work with. He seems like a tough guy.
Okay. Yeah. For this behind the scenes, they're mostly talking to cast and crew. He's in it, but you know, you can tell the careful language that everyone is using to say this man is impossible to work with. And it's much less guarded than other places you see that, which makes me believe that like this isn't a secret. Everybody knows this. So we could sort of openly talk about it, but we can't just be openly insulting to the man. But
he's a powerful dude, man. He made some money for the studios.
One guy says, like, I'd worked on Aliens, and what I knew about him is the man rolls a lot of film. Aliens, yeah. So he just does take after take. Also, like the prop guy was talking about how he came onto set, and there's a shot with a sort of thermos-looking mug in the foreground on Deckard's desk. And he had brought in like 5 mugs for him to look at, thinking like this is a normal amount of mugs for a prop designer to bring a director. And really, Scott just looked at them and was like, "Is this all that you brought me?"
Right.
Like, none of these. Go get more.
Yeah.
And so they just started bringing him hundreds of pencils, mugs, everything. And like everyone basically says he will not make a final decision until he's absolutely forced to, which, oh, is that an infuriating way to work? Because you just always have to have the next one handy, another option handy.
What it sounds like to me is that like he does not want the creative inputs of anybody else on the set. He doesn't want a prop person to pre-select 5 from the thousands of mugs that exist to be the options.
Right. He wants to see every mug in the world and choose one.
Your job is to just bring me all the mugs. I'll make the choice. I don't need you to filter the mugs. Bring me all the fucking mugs. This is my movie. This is all, every inch of it is my vision. Which is
insane.
It's
way
a
to
school
work.
Of thought with directors, you know, it's the opposite of letting go.
Sure, if you've got unlimited time and money, if it's not a business, then yeah, sure.
And these are the waning days of that. This is back when, you know, the director could, you know, I don't think anymore that happens. There's too many other fingers in the pie.
Yeah. I mean, my read on it was also just like a fear of making the wrong choice.
From him? Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, that could be. I can neither confirm nor deny that. I like the idea.
So I guess the original storyboards for the opening sequence, meaning not the opening, but the interview between the first replicant that we meet and the...
And Leon.
Leon who gets killed,
Leon
right? Leon's the replicant, but who kills the detective that's interviewing him, which is presumably why they bring in Deckard.
Yep. Holden gets killed.
Okay. So that character never existed. The original storyboards were like Deckard sitting in what looked like a cabin, like a regular looking cabin, right? So you're
in the woods, like a log cabin,
like a would be cabin in the woods. He's in the kitchen. So you can't see outside where he is. And you see a futuristic looking car in the window and a farmer guy dressed in farmer's clothing comes in and there's like a pot of soup that's heating up on the, so like a very normal looking scene, right? And this guy walks in and asks him, just walks right past Deckard straight to the soup and asks him, do you want any soup? And Deckard just kills him and then reaches into his mouth and pulls out this like aluminum denture looking thing that has a serial number on it.
God. It's pretty gruesome.
So that was like how you were sort of shocked into this world of clones and replicants.
I kind of like the way it goes better, honestly.
I think so too. I agree. There's no call to action for your hero in that one.
Yeah.
You don't get this moment where Deckard's like, I'm retired.
Yeah.
Which I think is important.
Well, and there's like a school of thought, and I heard Ridley, I think himself, pose the question in that same interview, does Deckard even exist before the first frame of this film?
Right. Because
how do you know he wasn't sat down at that noodle bar and switched on?
You know?
And the rest of it's all just, you know.
Well, and isn't that what makes, like, that's what bridges the gap for you, you've said this before, between like cyberpunk and noir.
Yeah. So I think that
it's the who am I?
So like I said, I read this book that broke down the history of noir. I forget who wrote it and where did I read it? Somebody asked me, where did you get that book? You know where I got it from? I saw it sitting on a teacher's desk at SVA when we went to school and I took it. And that's where I got a lot of good books from.
Thief. Yeah,
I just picked them up and I would just read whatever I saw. I went to school a little later in life and I went there like with a mission of like, I will absorb all of the things. And sometimes I forgot about that. And sometimes I was really good at remembering that. And at that time I was just like, info, feed it to me.
Yeah.
And so I don't know who wrote it or whatever, but it broke down the idea that neo-noir after A Touch of Evil, which is regarded as the final noir, is not about finding the interloper, but about finding the detective is in search of themselves. Still a detective story, still finding an interloper, but the tension of the movie is the director figuring out, who am I? And then cyberpunk is that. Cyberpunk at its core. And all these people are going to show up and fucking, well, nobody's going to show up because not a lot of people watch our show yet, but people are going to show up and say, no, but cyberpunk is about cybernetics. But like the school of cybernetics isn't about metal arms. Cybernetics mm-hmm. is about feedback loops. And then the central question that cybernetics gets to at like kind of the apex of this long field of study is, wait a minute, do we have actual consciousness or are our actions
right or free yeah, will
are our yeah. actions just feedback loops? And so the central question in all cyberpunk media, in addition to all of the other speculative fiction parts of it, you know, about rampant capitalism and stuff like that, is do people exist? Does the soul exist?
Well, and this one bridges that gap so well, because the could he be a replicant is such a sliver in this yep. movie. Whereas if you look at Total Recall or RoboCop, that's the entire movie. That's yep. the whole focus of the question is,
am I real?
Is yeah. Are you real? Do you exist? And in this one, it leans more to the noir than to the cyberpunk, yeah. but it's also it's in there. Absolutely. You know?
Yeah. It doesn't have to be loud. It just has to be, it's the backbone.
Yeah.
It's the backbone of the story.
It's there.
That central question of what, the cyberpunk story isn't necessarily the main question. It's the spine mm-hmm. of that everything else kind of connects back to.
Well, and apparently for Ridley Scott, that was in the background for him the whole time. And it wasn't.
It was totally part of the story. Ridley Scott never read the book.
Right.
I respect that choice.
Which it seems like they had gotten further and further away from the sort yeah. of original source absolutely. Material at yeah. that time.
I think that's absolutely right. And he was like, why would I read the book? I'm not making the book. I'm making the screenplay. You know, I need to read the screenplay. If I read the.
Again, this is mine. He didn't write it.
You know, I mean, but yeah. like to some extent, I think that's a really smart choice, because if you read the book, all you're going to do is be like, oh, but that's not in the screenplay. And you're going to fuck up mm-hmm. the writer's vision, you know? I would go with that choice. I don't know that I would have the wisdom to make that choice in advance, but in hindsight, I think that that's a wise move.
Takes a lot of confidence.
Yeah. Yeah. But it doesn't though. At the same time, like the script is the roadmap. It's right there.
Yeah. I hear you. But when you're a young director, you're like, I'm going to come in prepared. I'm going to kill like any sort of nerves yeah. leads you to be like, oh, I'm going to over research.
I think Ridley Scott has a lot of confidence.
Yeah, it sounds like
maybe
it.
Too
sounds
much
like
confidence, it. But you know,
yeah, he's not worried about making people uncomfortable.
No,
I guess the
no,
other
no,
thing
no. I don't think he has
I read
friends.
Was like, no, the set was a miserable place to be. Like, if you look at behind the scenes footage, they're all wearing masks because the smoke, they were just blowing smoke into the set constantly, yeah, and they were using like the type of smoke you'd use to smoke out a beehive.
Oh, that's weird.
I don't know why. That's someone said that in the making of, and also because it's raining so much in this movie, by the end of shooting, everything was like moldy and mildewy. So you'd walk onto this set that was like humid and mildewy and filled with smoke. Just sounds awful.
Yeah.
And then you'd work for 12 hours a day.
Probably at least. Yeah, exactly.
Plus, people probably smoking on set at that time.
Everybody's
too.
Chain just smoking. Awful. Yeah. We need more smoke in this scene. Yeah. Honestly, light up.
One of the producers, I guess, said he jokingly asked Ridley Scott if he had smoke billowed into his house. Like, he just likes to live like this. That's how he chooses to be.
You know, I gotta say too, the safety of like smoke technology has come a long way since back then.
Yeah.
Like, you hear people talking about, I think it was on the set of Aliens, they were talking about the smoke. Not Ridley Scott, James Cameron. And they were talking about the different kinds of smoke, because there's different smokes in different scenes. And they were like, it all of it was so toxic. There's this stuff called AB smoke, where it was like two chemicals that combined to make smoke. And they used a lot of that in Aliens, because so much of it, you had to see it react and happen on scene when like the acid would suddenly like start smoking. No, you needed there to be like a surface that suddenly produces smoke.
Okay.
So they had a lot of this.
It's not an atmosphere.
No, yeah. It's like chemical smoke reactions that they're dealing with. Stuff coming, you know, and like the A component coming out of like a gun and hitting like a surface that's got the B component. So it produces smoke on impact. Shit that you can't do anymore. It's just like, I imagine it just smelled like melting plastic the time.
Oh,
yeah. Melting plastic and ozone. Man, I keep thinking, I had a thought here and it slips away every time about this movie, Blade Runner. It'll come back sometimes. Maybe. Oh, so we were talking about how like this movie has been re-released many times. And as we said, it was shot and then seized by the producers to be edited as they saw fit, and then released that way. So the original theatrical cut was kind of a bomb. This is like an interesting thing too. To me, like, this is the birth of the director's cut. This is, I think, to my knowledge, the first director's cut. And it's crazy how it came to be. They recorded a voiceover for this movie. So they were like, nobody's going to know what the hell is going on here in this flick. So they brought in Harrison and they threw him in a booth and said, you're going to record this voiceover for the whole movie. He's just going to narrate the entire movie. Mm-hmm. And he didn't want to do it. He thought it was a terrible idea that would ruin the movie. And so he did the worst job he could do, trying to satisfy his contract with the hope that they would just not be able to use it. And that is the lesson,
kids. I genuinely hate the voiceover in this movie. So keep going. But I remember being like,
never do anything on camera that you don't want them to use, because they're going to use it. Yeah. That's the lesson. Wait, have you not seen the director's cut? Have you only seen the theatrical cut with the voiceover?
Yeah.
Meredith. We're talking about different movies.
My assignment wasn't to see the director's cut.
We're talking about different movies.
I went.
It's so fucking different. That's insane. I'm sorry. It never occurred to me. You have to hunt out the theatrical cut. I had no idea.
No, it's the only thing that came up. I went to watch it. I had to rent it. And it was, I'm pretty sure, the theatrical. Well, it had a voiceover.
Had Harrison Ford saying, that was city speak in the beginning. A pigged in of all these different languages.
I was not given options.
You should watch it again. You should watch the director's cut. So I'm serious.
you gotta
sorry.
These nuggets I'm of knowledge so in your head. You gotta have them come out your mouth.
Fair enough. But you went to film school, and I thought I thought this was common knowledge. I apologize.
I did not give a shit. A Blade Runner was not the movie that drove me towards film
school. Oh God, man, that's so crazy. Well, so what happened was, this movie kind of bombed because, as you said, everybody hated the voiceover and the studio didn't get it.
And it did. Like, yeah, as far as, we didn't go through any stats on this movie, but it had a $28 million estimated budget and it grossed like $32 million in the US. Yeah,
it did. So what happened was, I think it was on TV. Ridley got to do a TV release of his edit. And that's like the first director's cut. I don't know where it aired, but I'm pretty sure it was on TV, and then it was on Laserdisc, and then he got to do a full re-release of it as the director's cut, and that's the version most people see. I don't know that I've ever seen the theatrical cut, so maybe we should go do this again where I watch the theatrical and you watch.
We flip.
Yeah, we flip.
I'm really happy to know that, because the voiceover for me was just like, oh God.
Oh yeah, no, it's a much better movie. I didn't think that we would have to do that, because that comparison's been done to death.
Yeah.
Then more recently, he did something he called the Final Cut, which was the director's cut with a couple of additions and changes, most of which were fine. You know, they're subtle. It was like almost like a special edition Star Wars where like I can do a better effect now, you know, a little CG here and there and stuff like that. I don't really remember any significant changes. The only one that pissed me off is a change to a line of dialogue. There's a scene in the movie, and I don't know if it's in the theatrical cut now, to be honest, where when Rutger Hauer meets Terrell, when Roy Batty meets Terrell and tells him, I want more life. And he gouges out his eyes. He says, I want more life, Fokker.
I want more life, Father.
I don't know how it sounds in the theatrical cut, but in the director's cut, he very clearly says, Fokker. And Rutger Hauer has said in interviews that it was a word he invented. He wanted to create a portmanteau of father and fucker and make it one word so that he could imply both meanings at the same time. And that to me is the coolest fucking thing I've ever heard of an actor doing. And in the final cut, they change it so it sounds very clearly like fucker.
So in the director's cut, do you see that prop head? Like, do you see his thumbs go into the eyes?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Because it's so interesting because they didn't mention, I was watching this behind the scenes and they didn't mention the director's cut because they were talking about how they made this $20,000 prosthetic head.
And then you don't see it.
So that he could push into the eyes and it doesn't make the cut. It's not even in the movie.
It's a brief shot. It's brief, but it's not supreme.
But in the theatrical cut, you don't see it at all. They don't ever cut. You see him start to grab the head and that's it.
No, yeah. You see the thumbs disappear and like the glasses shift and stuff.
Yeah.
And like you might see a little blood, but there's a lot of screaming.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. And it's pretty gruesome if I recall. But then again, I've also been told that like, you know, people remember the eyes of the baby in Rosemary's Baby. As like one of the most iconic images of the movie. And it's not in the movie. There's no shot of the eyes. And
that's fascinating.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I've been told upon that on both fronts. So maybe it's one of those, maybe I'm imagining that I saw it. I got started on this track and we skipped it, but the comparison, have you seen Blade Runner 2049?
I did. I saw it once. I think I watched the two movies back to back because I wanted to watch 2049. I had never seen Blade Runner. Okay. So I think I watched Blade Runner and then Blade Runner 2049. But I remember very little about it besides the fact that Ryan Gosling's in it. And it's much more to do with the replicant question, isn't it?
I'm like you. I don't remember much about it either because I just remember it being boring.
Yeah.
So that's what I was saying before, is that like Blade Runner is fun. It has a pace to it. It's fun to watch. It is dark. It is a brooding kind of movie, right? But like noir is fun. The Crow is fun. Like it encompasses, like, I don't know, there's something enticing about it. There's nothing there in Blade Runner 2049. There's nothing neat about it. There's nothing cool. There's nothing where you're like, I'm into this world. I'm into this setting. It's just a bummer.
Is there time travel in 2049?
There is not.
There's not. Okay. I thought there was like an element of like a loop of time or something. I must be flipping that with another
possibly
movie.
Looper.
Clearly I'd need to rewatch it.
Yeah, there's no time.
Did people like 2049?
Yeah, people liked it a lot.
Okay.
I mean, Dennis, I don't know if it's Dennis or Dene. I don't know why I decided it. His name was pronounced Dene, but in my head, I pronounce it Dene, like the S is silent. But I know his last name is very complicated. And I think it's Villeneuve or something like that. He also did Dune. And for me, his movies, you know, I said my take on Blade Runner 2049 was that it's a very beautiful movie. It's a very lyrical movie. It's got a very, I don't know. It's very artsy. And I felt like I want this movie to be displayed on a loop at the Museum of Modern Art, and it shouldn't be anywhere near a Cineplex. Like it's not a movie I want to watch ever, but I can't fail to recognize its competence. It's the excellence of its execution. It's just, I don't need to watch this. I'll rewatch Blade Runner just about any day of the week. but you know, not.
I liked Dune.
And I felt that way about Dune too. Yeah. But I also don't like the book. Yeah. I know that's like extremely poor nerd form, but I hated Dune, the book.
You're allowed to not like it.
I also don't like Rush. I'm just pissing off all the nerds right now. All the hardcore D&D nerds love Rush, love Dune. Not me. I don't like either. I like Rush. It has a few songs. I like Subdivisions and I like, but I like Tom Sawyer, but I'm not like a Rush guy.
I don't know anything about it.
It's a band. Rush.
You like the band Rush. And that's a nerd
Nerds
thing.
Love Rush. Nerds.
Got it.
Nerds love Rush. Nerds love Dune, the novel, and probably the movie. I don't like either. The novel also bored me.
I've never read it. I've seen many different versions of, like, I saw the, was it 90s? Was that a TV?
Oh, yeah. On the Sci-Fi
movie?
Channel.
Yeah. So I've seen all of that. It's like
that's a real
four $12 hours budget or more movie. Of it. And then, yeah. And then I liked the Timothée Chalamet movie. That's not his movie. He's in it. But I liked it. I'd see it again. I will see the next
again,
one.
Again, I kind of find, and I recognize it as a failure of a movie. But the, what's that director's name? He's so famous. The guy who did Twin Peaks. David Lynch.
No, Lynch.
It's a failure of a movie. It was panned. It was a flop. But I kind of think the David Lynch movie is at least more fun. There's a lot more charisma in the David Lynch movie than the Denis Villeneuve movie. Like, it feels like it's occupied by actual human beings, where the Villeneuve movie feels like it's occupied by statues, but that is also how the novel feels. The novel feels like it's statues.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember feeling that way. Again, I have to go watch it again. I remember really liking that movie.
A lot of people did.
Walked out of
a lot
it
of people
feeling,
did.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm a weirdo, so I don't fault people for liking it at all.
I'm also, sorry, this is off topic. I'm just realizing that my mountain of pillows is behind me for these last two episodes we've shot. So
look at those pillows.
We got this couch delivered yesterday. Yes. We did not order any pillows for the couch. And we got 10 of
That's
them.
Nice.
And now we don't know what to do. No, maybe two of them I can use. I don't know what to do with the other.
Give them to your dog.
So just pillows all over the house, everywhere.
Stitch them together and make a dog.
Like, New York City apartments are small. Yeah. We don't have room for anything. We don't need actively.
Donate
so
them. Take them down.
I think that's probably what will happen. Yes, they're going to go to Goodwill or something like that.
Free pillows. Freepillows.com.
I know. It's just like, but we can't sit on our couch, all of us, because there's a mountain of pillows.
You got to get one of those vacuum bags.
They just like, it was like a comedy yesterday. They kept pulling them out and putting them on the couch. And I was like, what
Where
is
are
happening
the here? Clown pillows? They're coming pillows. Out of the clown pillow car.
Where are these coming from? Who needs 10 pillows with their small sectional couch? I don't know, but apparently
what
we
do you
did.
Call it? The handkerchiefs that come out of your sleeve, but pillows forever.
Yeah. Just kept coming. So unfortunately, if Gladiator, the other episode we recorded today comes out, I apologize for my mountain of pillows in the background. They're distracting for anyone.
It's like we did an episode on Gladiator. Oh no, the American Gladiators episode. Yes.
The American Gladiators.
Also, this movie inspired one of my favorite songs, Astro Creep 2000 by White Zombie.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. There's just so many cool beats in this movie. So many fun interactions. There's, for an action-y movie, there's a lot of acting. There's a lot of work for actors to do. A lot of scenes that are just kind of conversations, you know?
Yeah, the action sort of comes in short bursts. They're not these long, drawn-out scenes.
There's like one scene that I would really call an action scene, which is the fight with Roy Batty. Like, other than that, like, they're kind of just homicides.
Yeah, well, you get the the chase scene
with Zora.
Of Zora, yeah. Who apparently that was her, the actress's pet snake.
Oh, no shit.
Darling.
That's great.
Which is why she was so like comfortable with the snake.
Yeah. That's
fun piece of trivia, right?
Good. don't be like surprised. A
useful
snake.
Skill.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I just mean,
on your resume.
Snakes can turn on you, so that's why they're snakes. You know, come prepared with your own snake. I feel a little better about that.
Yes.
I wonder if that's how she got the role.
Yeah, her
boss. She brings her own snake.
Probably. Yeah. Exactly. It's on her resume. Snake owner. They're like, you are the person. Yeah. And then Daryl Hannah has a very athletic, gymnastics-driven fight scene.
She has all that stuff though with Sebastian though, where she's just hanging out and pulling hard-boiled eggs out of boiling water with her bare hands, and they're talking. And he's just like, I made you, your friends, the people I made my friends, I made you. And she's trying to...
But she beats the shit out of Deckard.
She does. She doesn't beat the shit out of Sebastian. She's trying to flirt Sebastian into getting her up to up to Terrell. Deckard shoots her and she does that thing where she like kicks the ground and stuff while she's dying. Horrific stuff. I think there's a stunt double there who fails to match Daryl Hannah at all. There's like a couple shots where it's just
so
like
the story, it's actually a male stunt double. The way at one point her leg kicks like almost straight up and she couldn't get the angle quite right. Yeah. And so they brought him in, put him in her outfit, and he does the kick and then that's it. That's just
oh, that's it.
That
cause there's a moment
shot.
Where I see a face and I'm like, is that Daryl? That doesn't look like her.
Well, there might be other stunt double stuff, but like specifically him being brought in for that. And he was like, and then I told them they get this one shot. And then I headed back to the dressing room and changed out of those clothes.
All right.
It was very, it sounded like it was very threatening to his masculinity.
Maybe he just played it up for the interviews. Like he knows what he does for a living. I don't know.
Perhaps.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, sadly, I have to go move my car soon. But is there anything else about this movie that...
Probably.
I mean, apparently I have to go watch the director's cut before I can even talk about it properly. So
that blows my mind.
Sorry for wasting everyone's time.
No, it's not. It's interesting. I wish I had known that coming into it, though, because I think that we would have had a very different conversation. Like, a person who had only seen the director's cut, you know what I mean? Like, I think that there's a person who had only seen the theatrical cut talking about it to someone else. I mean, we saw different movies. Like, it's crazy.
Yeah. Well, I'm interested to know that because there were points at this movie where like you're saying how fun it is and I'm like, I understand the merits of this movie, but like I would revisit Total Recall before I would revisit this movie. And I wonder if that assessment remains true after watching the director's cut.
So Total Recall is a lot more fun.
Right.
Whereas, because it's just so insane.
But like, I don't need a movie to be fun. There was just beats of this movie where I was like finding myself.
Blade Runner is just cool. Like,
not
just
into
kinda,
it.
Oh, it's so cool. I want to be that kind of cool. I find that kind of cool, appealing. And Blade Runner 2049 is extremely not cool. I don't ever want to live in that world. Oh, God. Oh, God.
Sure.
It hurts my soul. Nightmare times. So, yeah. I don't really have anything else to say about Blade Runner. I mean, I do, but I'm done for now. That's all I got for now. In the version you saw, was there... shots at the very end of them driving up into the mountains and the voiceover of she was different. She lived for a long time. Mm-hmm. And then shots, were there shots of a unicorn running in the woods?
I don't remember specifically a unicorn.
Okay. So there's the folded paper unicorns throughout the movie. And at the end of the movie, they show up as a dream that Deckard is having. And but that's maybe not in the theatrical cut because Ridley Scott explains, I used the footage of the unicorn from my other movie, Legend, to get those shots. And if I'm not mistaken, the shots of them driving up into the mountains through the woods were unused footage from The Shining that Kubrick had shot.
Oh,
the studio slammed in there.
Yeah, they look very... out of place, but I think they're supposed to, but they, you know, they look very out of place for the rest of the aesthetic of the rest of this movie.
Turns out she was a replicant, but different. She just lived. Happy ending.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
She didn't have the 4 year.
That doesn't happen in the director's cut. There's no driving up into the mountains.
Oh, okay. She's dying.
They don't explain.
Yeah, she's going to die. It's not happy.
Maybe just sort of ends.
They don't need to say. Right. I did see alternate happy ending written somewhere. So that's definitely the ending that I got.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a different movie.
It's a weird movie to have a happy ending. It's very unnecessary.
Well, it was, I mean,
to be like, and everything was
fine.
Yeah,
but you're trying to make money in the theater. I totally get the instinct, but obviously it does not serve the film.
Yeah. The famous, one of the most famous happy ending rewrites is Little Shop of Horrors.
Oh, yeah. You've said that.
Because in the stage version, they all die. The plant consumes them all, except for maybe Seymour, because he has to live with the guilt of Audrey and everyone going. And in the movie, it's like he saves her from the plant and they go on to live in there. Somewhere that's green.
We should check out that movie because it's a really interesting one.
Little Shop?
It's a super interesting movie.
That's a good one. I love that movie. If we're going to do a musical, that sounds like a good one to
do. We should do.
That or Crybaby.
But barely a musical. It's got a few musical numbers.
Oh. Yeah, and after watching Crybaby.
Did you watch it recently?
It's like, it's not. I feel like if we're going to talk, I love it too, but I feel like if we're going to talk about John Waters, we have to talk about one of his
pre-Crybaby films.
More like, we've got to talk about like Pink Flamingos or something that is actually disgusting. Crybaby is a pretty.
Oh, no, it's mainstream.
It's
him crossing into mainstream cinema.
Like you get hints of, or I guess, I don't know the original Hairspray, how.
Hairspray's
gross or not that
Hairspray is pretty mainstream. It's right. I would call it mainstream.
I would imagine.
Yeah. It was on TV
like
all the time.
Pink Flamingos is the way to go.
Pink Flamingos is not mainstream. Well, we gotta do I love his movies, but I do think it's super interesting where I guess back then you could do it. Like he was making what amounted to not avant-garde, but like underground grindhouse gay cinema. Not porn, but that's the way to describe it.
It's not far off. Yeah. Like
there are some porny moments.
Yes.
There's
for
some
sure.
bestiality in that one in particular.
Yeah. Like the most off putting, I suppose, way to put it, part of Crybaby is that like Hatchet Face exists and it's unquestioned.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that and Tracy Lords.
In Crybaby?
Yeah, that's a behind the camera thing. So Tracy Lords is the girl who gets recruited into pornography by the pornographer. That's her true story. She was a very famous porn actress. And then it came out like years later that she was 16. And then he put her in the movie to basically play herself. Yeah, I mean, she's great.
Yeah,
she's great.
He likes to ride some very fine lines.
Oh, I don't think it was, but I think obviously she was game for it. And I don't think it was an indictment of her at all. I think that together they were steering the industry that she had sort of transcended away from.
But
I know that was a big controversy with that movie too, because again, mainstream kind of family entertainment really in that movie, not family, but like a movie that you would definitely let your 11 and 12 year olds watch.
Yeah. There's nothing that offensive about it.
No.
All right. Well, now we've teased a future John
Waters
episode.
A whole bunch of stuff in this. We got to listen to our own show and be like, what did we say we were going to do?
Sometimes I write them. I've gotten to, when I do my pass on them, to write them down. So I've started to keep a log of that. So we will come back to some of these instead of just letting them linger there forever.
I love John Waters so much. I love that. I just love that guy.
Yeah, he's great in an interview, but I listened to Ricky Lake has a podcast and she interviewed him on it, which was pretty fantastic.
Oh man,
because they've got a shorthand, they really like each other.
Oh, good. There was a but
and a similar outlook to the industry.
I was worried about what you were going to say next.
Oh no, they seem to he's her mentor, and it put, oh my god. Okay, we got to do a John Waters episode.
We should do a Ricky Lake episode.
Ricky Lake show.
We should go get,
well, so it put Ricky Lake's 90s talk show in a totally different context for me.
Oh, yeah.
because it was like, of all of the trash talk shows, hers was like with intention. Yeah. Like she knew what she was making. Yeah. And she loved yes. it because it was in the John Waters universe.
I wouldn't be surprised to find out if like she was calling John, like, what do you think about this next week? I'm going to have this person on. And he cameoed
on a couple of episodes.
Of course. Of course.
All right. We will get into all of this. All right. Thank you to Annie Villalobos, our editor and producer.
Thank you to Studio 71, our distributor and producing partner. Heather Vaughn, our brilliant artist who did the wonderful artwork for our show. And
great artwork.
You know, we buy music from Epidemic Sound. So,
yeah. The other contributor that we pay for. We pay you monthly.
Man, that'd be a great
welcome
title sequence, just receipts for everybody's labor on the film and like with what they got paid.
Yeah.
That's a cool idea.
I guess it makes it sound like we don't pay our artists, which we do.
Oh, that's true.
But
that's true.
But we appreciate their work somewhat differently.
Absolutely, yeah. All right. Good night. Good luck. Watch more movies.
Bye-bye.